How about this? The glow of planets outside our solar system has been spotted in the first direct detections of light emitted by alien worlds. The two planets were detected in infrared light, an emission of heat that is not visible to the human eye. There are no conventional photographs, but astronomers are ecstatic nonetheless. The gas giant worlds, each around a different star, were discovered previously by noting the gravitational wobbles that they induce in their host stars, which is an indirect method. Both are roughly Jupiter-sized and hot, orbiting very close to their stars. Each completes a year in less than 4 days. That's pretty fast. The observations, called a milestone by one analyst, were a surprising and convergence of work by two separate teams. They simply say it's an awesome experience. So we'll be talking with Daniel Derda about that in a second, planetary scientist. And also, just a few days ago, an asteroid, it's called 2005 FN, came within 95,000 miles from the planet. That's pretty close. How big was that asteroid? I do not know, but that tells you that they're still all out there. In a moment, Asteroids and Planets with Dan Derda on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Dan Derda is a planetary scientist and is currently a research scientist at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado, and an adjunct professor in the Department of Sciences at Front Range Community College. His research interests include the subject of collisional and dynamic evolution of main belt and near-Earth asteroids, comets, interplanetary dust, as well as airborne observations of the formation and detection of asteroidal satellites and the size distribution of dust from the catastrophic disruption of meteor samples. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast, Dan Derda. Hi, Dan. How are you?
Oh, excellent, George. Good to talk to you again.
Do you know what we're coming up to with you?
What is that?
April 28th, 2001.
Oh, my gosh. That sounds like it might have been our first show, perhaps.
That was our very first show, and I was asked to fill in. Can you believe that? Four years already.
Time flies.
It does. It does indeed.
That's been a lot of fun.
A couple things. This new announcement today, the glow of planets outside our solar system have been spotted in the first direct detections of light emitted by alien worlds. Is that a big, big story?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's kind of a, to quote Alan Boss, another researcher from Carnegie Institution who really specializes in this kind of thing, it really is kind of a major milestone. We've been finding planets around other stars now. I mean, it's kind of an amazing statement in just itself to be sitting here calmly talking about the fact that, yeah, there are, we know about hundreds of planets around other stars out there. This is only since about 1995. This has been the holy grail of planetary astronomy for a great many people for centuries, to think about, you know, other worlds out there, not just, you know, worlds here in our own solar system, but other worlds out there amongst all those points of light we see in the nighttime sky. It's absolutely miraculous. And we've almost gotten to the point now where we nonchalantly talk about it. I think that in itself is amazing.
Tell me about this telescope that is allowing us to do some of these new things.
This is the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is sort of the infrared equivalent of the Hubble Space Telescope. This is one of the of NASA's four great observatories, and it does basically for in the world of infrared astronomy, the detection of the heat coming from astronomical objects. It does for that world what Hubble does for optical astronomy.
How come these planets that we're finding, Dan, are always the big ones, the gaseous ones?
Well, that's probably just a selection effect of our still limited technology. As amazing as Hubble and the other large ground-based telescopes that are observing these planets and Spitzer, they have their limits. We can only technologically build so large a telescope either on the surface of the planet, planet Earth, or, you know, to build something that you're going to then, you know, loft off the planet that weighs many, many tons. So we're kind of limited. If we could build, you know, infinitely large telescopes, we'd be able to, you know, to separate the very faint light reflected off of the surface of an extraterrestrial planet near its star, and separate away that very faint light and see it separated in space away from its parent star. But it's a very difficult problem. It's kind of like, well, you know, of course, planets don't emit their own V visible light. They
right.
only reflect the light from
their
local little sun, just like yeah. we do. But, you know, looking at the distant stars from way back here on Earth, I mean, they're you know, look like faint points of light to our eyes in the sky, but to a telescope, even, you know, a pretty big one, they can be kind of bright. But the little faint, feeble light of these planets sitting so close to them in space, it's kind of like trying to look for the light coming out of a firefly sitting on the side of a big searchlight, right? All you see is the searchlight. There's no way you're going to pick out that little faint light. But you can play a trick. So there are sort of these indirect methods, then, of picking out these distant planets. If you can't look for them directly because they're too faint next to their host star,
right.
you can detect them indirectly. They're, you know, planets that orbit the star. Of course, if you get a big enough planet, small enough star, you really have to sort of change your point of view. Really, planets don't orbit their parent stars. The stars, and the planets in their particular systems really orbit their common center of mass. It's kind of like
everything's moving at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
It's that point in space. Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, like two dumbbells. You know, like the two weights on the end of a dumbbell. If you want to balance in between, you know, put the stick sort of on your finger like
yeah.
a teeter totter and have a balance. You gotta put that in the center of mass between the two. As planets orbit their stars, they orbit that center of mass. It makes the star wobble around this little point in space and reflects, if you will, the orbital motion of the planet. We can look for that wobble in the positions of distant stars and detect planets that way. We can see planets around other stars when perhaps if their orbit is lined up just along our line of sight very fortuitously, we can actually see the star or the planet itself pass across the disk of the distant star. Of course, we don't see the disk of the star. We just see the light of the star temporarily, very dimly, dim by maybe a percent or half a percent as that planet eclipses its star. Again, we don't see the planet. We just see the effect of it eclipsing the light of the
and
star.
And we assume it's there.
Techniques.
Now, let's do some math for a second here, Dan. If we have found over 100 planets so far.
Yeah, it's like 130 or 140.
Okay, how many star systems would that be? I mean, are we finding only one planet in a system, you know, where there's a star and then we find a planet? Or have we found a system where there's two or three planets there?
We found several systems like that. Many of the systems that are on that list of 130 or 140 other stars out there that have planets around them are just a single detection of a, you know, some sort of a gas giant planet.
Okay, but there could be more planets then, right?
There are several now where we've actually detected a system now. You can see the effects of not only just one sort of superimposed wobble, if you will, on the star's motion, but several. And that's telling you that there are several. In fact, you can even, from the size of the wobble, if you will, you can deduce the mass of that planet that's inducing it. So is it a big Jupiter or something smaller like a Uranus or a Neptune? We've been able to detect in a couple of stars a series of various wobbles that all kind of break down to be something like a Jupiter with a Saturn and then maybe something like a Uranus in there too. So it's, you know, we're not only starting to detect planets around other stars, we're starting to detect entire solar systems around these other stars.
All right, here's a speculative question. What percent of the stars out there might have planets around them?
Well, let's see. The observations are telling us that something like a few percent of the stars that we look at have these ones that we can detect. But and we'll come back to this in a second. Again, this gets back to your original question, actually,
right.
about biases. But, you know, given what we know about our own solar system, how it formed by just looking at the evidence in the meteorites, the ages of the meteorites that are the remnants of the formation process of the planets, they tell us that, you know, the Earth and the other planets formed around the sun right when it was forming. It seemed to be a byproduct just of the fact the sun itself formed as a star. We see many, many, many disks of dusty debris around very young stars in other clusters around us in space. And again, these indirect detections of many planets, biased as those detections are, around many other stars. I'm suspecting, you know, that if you allow for the fact that it might be a little difficult to perhaps form planets in a multiple, you know, a binary star system where the tugs in the pools of this, you know, this other major mass in there might possibly upset the process. That's by no means necessarily true. There may well be. Even if you allow for that, okay, maybe half or two-thirds of the other stars out there are binary stars. That means the other half or a third, you know, formed like the sun by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Might be a common process. I wouldn't doubt at all that a quarter to a half the stars out there might have planetary systems.
Which is a lot. It's huge.
Yeah, there's, you know, a couple hundred billion stars in just our own galaxy alone.
Okay, so if just in our galaxy alone there's 100 billion stars and 25% of them have at least one planet, you're talking about billions of planets.
Billions and billions. To paraphrase Carl Sagan, he maintained he never actually used that phrase, billions and
billions.
All
right. But if that's the case, and I'm pretty sure it is, I'm beginning to get to a point where I believe in probability like this.
I don't think any astronomers that you would talk to would be surprised by a number like that.
Would they have been 25 years ago? If we were doing a coast-to-coast show 25 years ago, and we were talking about planets and other systems and stuff, would they have freely have said, as they all are, you're absolutely right, when they come on this program, they're talking about life and everything else, and we'll get into that later. But would they have said this 25 years ago on this show?
Some would have. I don't think you'd find as large a fraction. It's becoming, you know, it's getting a little bit more in vogue. It becomes, of course, much easier to discuss when you know, pioneering astronomers have done the very difficult footwork that's unpopular and doesn't get results right away, to put in the very hard work it takes to develop these techniques, test them, and then validate them. That's hard work. You got people like Jeff Marcy out there in California doing great work. I mean, Jeff is just one of several people now that are doing it. It takes hard work by people like that. So they have made it possible for us to stand here today and so easily say this. You know, a couple decades ago, three, four decades ago, you would have found a few hardcore people, but the prevailing ideas, we just didn't have the base of knowledge about, you know, we've learned a lot about the formation of the planets and the formation and evolution of the planets in our solar system and the observations of other young star systems just because of the technologies that have come along since then. So it's just made it a lot easier. We're standing on the shoulders of giants, right? We see farther than they do because
Absolutely.
Of all the work that they did ahead of us. So it's the natural progression, I think.
Now, if we look at our solar system, here's planet Earth teeming with water. You look at Mars, once had lots of water. We look at now other...
Jupiter's moon Europa, which has a whole
has a lot of
kilometer
water.
Deep ocean below that.
Exactly. Titan, methane. And that's just in our solar system. Let's talk about Earth-like planets now with this, and let's paint a picture of what that could be. If we're talking about billions of planets, what if only 5% of those billions of planets just in our galaxy were Earth-like? Is that a fair percent, you think? 5% could be Earth-like in terms of water and maybe close to their star?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, again, if you take just our own solar system and you look for, you know, okay, our you know, the nine planets in our solar system, and I guess I'm among those historical people who counts Pluto as one of the nine planets, but okay, even if you want to say something like eight major planets in our solar system, again, you've got, as you just went through the list, you've got possibilities, you know, of life on the Earth. We've got good possibilities for Mars, possibly Europa. There are some people, I think you've just had David Grinspoon on your show recently, he's discussing the possibilities for even life in the clouds, on the cloud decks of Venus.
That's true.
As hostile a world as
well, we're going to talk about Venus a little bit. I've got so many things to talk with you about.
It's been a very active spring here, lots of great planetary stuff. So right here in our own solar system, out of eight planets, let's say even conservatively, you've got maybe, you know, two worlds that are, you know, in some ways considered kind of Earth-like, maybe at the extreme. That's a quarter of the planets right there, if ours is typical. You know, you've got tens of billions or 100 billion other planets out there.
Now, what about similarities then? Let's assume then that we have many, many Earth-like planets, and they're out there now.
Sounds like we're running through the Drake equation.
Exactly. if we were to fly over these many planets and these other systems, and we could see the oceans and all this, what are the possibilities then of some kind of life there? I mean, we're already beginning to think Mars has something, and I'm probably convinced that Europa might have something. What are the possibilities of whatever we share in this universe, which I think is a lot, is also out on these other planets then?
Yeah, as you work down the factors of the now famous Drake equation, which is sort of what we're implicitly doing here, Frank Drake, back in the 1960s, he was very interested in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence via, he realized that radio communication was probably a pretty efficient way to communicate through the vast distances of space, mm-hmm. because the radio waves can penetrate through the gas and dust of the galaxy and not be blocked. To help kind of think his way through the various, these various issues, he kind of wrote down this equation of, as we're discussing right now, just these various multiplicative factors. How many stars are there in the galaxy? What fraction of those stars have planets? What fraction of those planets are Earth-like? What fraction of those Earth-like planets actually, have the conditions in which life can evolve? And now we're getting more uncertain, but boy, again, using it, we've got statistics of one. We have one planet that we know of. And, you just don't know from one example, is it a typical example and it's very common, or was something just absolutely magical and special about this particular place, the Goldilocks sort of, thing. But coming back to the Earth, given how rapidly we have evidence of very simple, the chemical precursors, sort of biochemical markers, if you will, of life, the perturbations to the various types of carbon isotopes that life tends to do, the various weights, the different flavors, if you will, of carbon atoms. Life does some funny things where it prefers to work with one weight of carbon atom versus the other, and it tends to change this isotope ratio, if you will, out there in the world. We see evidence for those kinds of perturbations and actual literal fossil evidence of early microbial life on Earth, effectively as soon as the Earth was capable of sustaining life. And again, kind of like the observation that we see many, many planets and many, many dusty disks forming around other stars, it seems to be a natural planet formation, seems to be a very natural byproduct of star formation. Here on the Earth, it looks as though life was able to get going as early as it was able to,
yeah.
And that seems to imply, at least on the Earth, it was a fairly common, relatively easy process to get going. And that, to many people, hints that, if nothing else, at least simple forms of life, microbial forms of life, the equivalent of microbial forms of life, might be rather common out there.
And step it up even a little bit. There's so many varieties of life on this planet. Let's just tuck humans away for a moment. There's got to be a lot of planets out there that might have fish life or some kind of small animal life.
Oh, sure.
That's out there.
Actually, anything more than a single microbial cell, when you start talking more complex, what we call eukaryotic life, cells with actual nuclei in them that divide and have a separate nucleus, that is a pretty complex form. And you start to get to multicellular big beasts and vegetables and stuff like that. We've only had life like that on the Earth for the last, 600 million years or so. That seems to be a little bit more complex, a little bit more difficult to do. But, I'll tell you, even the concrete, example of finding, an independent evolution of even something as simple as something like blue-green algae, blue-green microbes, that alone would be a stupendous, amazing discovery.
Well, that is true. That is true.
Of course, we all hope, though, and we all, Seth Shostak is, I've heard him very confidently state lately that we're going to know in 10 or 20 years. We're going to have made contact, probably, with obviously, if you're making contact, technologically, it's with something better than a microbe. He's pretty confident that we're going to make that discovery. I guess I'm remaining more agnostic, but boy, I hope he's right.
I wonder what these animals, if they are there, would look like. I wonder if they'd have similarities to animals on this planet where, we've all got eyes, ears, nose, mouth. I wonder if they'd have similarities like that.
Well, nature, the physical laws that govern, the world out there, chemistry and biology and physics and all that, tends to come up with rather optimal solutions. Spheres are the most efficient way to pack stuff into the smallest volume. So you tend to see, soap bubbles around, planets around. Biological solutions.
Exactly. They're very similar. Stay with us, Dan. Back in a moment with you, and eventually we'll start talking about asteroids and life on other planets as well. Human life, maybe. alien life.